You're listening to Adventures in Jewish History with Rabbi Danny Sackstein.
Good afternoon and welcome to Soul to Soul. Always wonderful to be with you on a Wednesday afternoon live from our studio here in Johannesburg. It's 1:14 and we are continuing with our crash course in Jewish history. We finished off last Wednesday discussing the Haskalah, the Enlightenment, which swept across Western and Eastern Europe. And had a dramatic effect both on the general world and on the Jewish world. The Jewish world, as a result of these new ideas and the new formed acceptance in society, which doors were now open to Jews that had previously been closed for many centuries, meant that Jews were now going out into the non-Jewish world, non-Jewish society, and were embracing these ideas of equality, of rights for all, of being protected before the law, which was a wonderful development for the Jewish world. But however, it also meant that we see these ideas were embraced by the Jewish world and meant that many Jews left the traditional observance and connection to our holy tradition. And so there were responses to these new challenges that the Jewish world faced. And the first response we spoke about last week was the development of the yeshiva movement. Reb Chaim Volozhin, at the beginning of the 19th century, followed on the teachings of his Rebbe, of his teacher, the Vilna Gaon, who instructed him, who guided him, who advised him that they should open up an institution which would be responsible for the educating of future leaders within the Jewish world. And that was the Volozhin Yeshiva, which was opened and established in 1806. And for 70 years, Volozhin pretty much achieved its goal of producing leaders in the Orthodox Jewish world. And those leaders opened up their own yeshivot, and therefore the yeshiva movement spread far and wide across Lithuania and became the mainstay of Jewish learning, of Jewish education, and of ensuring that the holy tradition of Judaism would be passed on to the next generation. There were other responses too to those challenges of those times, in particular the challenge of Haskalah, of the Enlightenment movement within Europe. And that second response in Lithuania, where most of us South Africans come from, us Litvaks, was the Musa movement. The Musa movement took place in the 1840s and 1850s in Lithuania. It was led by Rabbi Yisrael Salanta. Rabbi Yisrael was a brilliant person, a great visionary, and he understood how further innovations were necessary within the Jewish world. And in particular, he felt that in many cases, we were losing the forest from the trees. And although as Jews, we were scrupulous in the observance of halacha, but very often the bigger picture was lost in terms of the importance of developing our character, the importance of having self-control, the importance of refining ourselves as human beings as the Torah wants us to do. As a result of the vicissitudes of the exile and the suffering of the Jewish people, so very often the messages get a little bit mixed up, and the understanding and clarity that we should have as Jews in terms of our mission in this world and as our responsibility to develop ourselves and our character, it was sometimes getting a little bit murky and not so clear. And so the Muslim movement was designed to make it very clear, a conscious effort, a very well laid out plan of how we develop ourselves as human beings and how we develop our character traits in order to fulfill our potential that God has given each and every one of us. So that was the wonderful movement of Musa that Rabbi Yisrael Salanta introduced into the Eastern European Jewry at the latter part of the 19th century. And it also came to address some of the defects that existed at that time in the Jewish world. In other words, because of the suffering, because of the poverty, because of the hardship of the life, so very often observant Jews were a little bit tatty and they were uncultured and insular. And so the Muslim movement not only planned to focus on developing from within, but also to creating a more refined product, a more refined Jew on the outside as well. On top of this, there were many complications in the society. And unfortunately, there was much enmity towards the established Jewish community, the establishment of the Jewish world. And that was largely caused by the terrible decrees of the Tsar at the time. One of the decrees of the Tsar was that all Jews had to serve in the army from the age of 18 for 25 years. How's that for conscription? 25-year conscription that the Jews were subject to. And the Tsar then decides that the Jews at 18 weren't really ready for the army. They weren't able to integrate quick enough. And so they were conscripted at the age of 12 years old. So unbelievable. I gave the shiur this morning to a group of ladies, and some of the ladies were remembering how their family members poked out their eyes in order that they wouldn't be conscripted. It was common that people cut off their index finger on their right hand so they couldn't pull a trigger on a rifle, and therefore they would also be exempt to be subjected to, 25 years, and then in addition to that, another 6 years. So we're talking about 31 years. It's just unbelievable to even think about it. The system was called kantonistim. A canton was a basic training camp. And the way it worked was the Russian authorities would come to a town. So let's say, they came to, I live in Glen Hazel. So let's say they came to Glen Hazel. And they would tell the leaders of the community in Glen Hazel, next Wednesday, we're going to be arriving with our buses, and we want there to be 100 Jewish boys, 12-year-old boys that will be conscripted into the army. We don't care where you get those 100 from, but we're going to come next week to Kosher World, to the parking lot over there, and we want 100 Jews to be there to be conscripted. So that's how it worked. Now, what happened then? It filtered down into the community, and the leaders of the community will certainly not send their children. So the child of the shoichet, the child of the chairman of the community, the child of the rav would not be sent. Who would be sent? Who would be the ones who would be subject to fill up this quota? So that would come from the poor, that will come from the orphans, that will come from the defenseless. And obviously it was a very cruel system which caused a tremendous amount of friction and animosity in the community. And those that were part of the group that was forced to go, they never forgot it. And till this day, they never forgot it. We see that there are political parties that have been formed by this. So one of the things that surprised me when I was living in Israel was the unbelievable animosity there is towards religious people, towards observant people. It took me by surprise. I was shocked by it. But a lot of it comes from this history. When we understand the history, we see where it comes from. They're actually political parties that are based on this enmity and this hatred against observant people. So as a result of that, it caused animosity, and it caused this undercurrent of anger and aggression towards those that ran the administrators and that were in charge of the community. Please stay with us. We'll be back in a moment.
You're listening to Adventures in Jewish History with Rabbi Danny Sachstein.
Many did oppose the system of the leaders who ran the community not sending their children to the army and not being part of the quota that the Russian government demanded. Many rabbis opposed the system. Those rabbis that were against it and said we should have a lottery, it should be fair, it should be, everybody should be subject to it. Those rabbis usually lost their jobs quite quickly. And, to be a rabbi in Eastern Europe was not a simple thing at all in the 19th century. It's not easy to be a rabbi today, but it was much worse back then in the 19th century. And, there's actually an autobiography written by Rav Kook's father-in-law, the Aderes. It was Rabbi Eliyahu David Rabinovitz Tumim. He was the Rav of Ponovich and the Rav of Slutsk. And he was one of the great Litvisha Rabbonim in the 19th century. And he later came to Yerushalayim and was a Rav in Yerushalayim together with Rav Shmuel Salant. He writes in his autobiography, which was printed by Mossad Rav Kook, they always sell out very quickly. They're never enough printed, and they're quite incendiary, so they don't print enough. But there's one story that we'll just share to give us an understanding of what it was like to be a Rav in those days. The Aderes was the Rav of a community, and he was not paid for 16 weeks, his salary. And it's not that the community didn't have the money. They had the money, but they spent it on other things. They thought other things were more important. It came to a point where he was not able to put food on the table to feed his family. And so he decided that if they didn't pay him, he would go on strike. And he refused to paskin any of the shilas. So any of the shalas in Taras HaMishpacha, in Nida, with regards to the mikvah, he didn't paskin. Any kashrus shalas didn't paskin. And in observant Jewish community, things pretty much shut down very quickly when the Rav wasn't giving clarity and psak in all of the different areas of Jewish living. And so the committee thought, you know, what a chutzpah, he's not paskining in shalas. They took him to the greatest Rav of Lithuania at the time, the Rav of Kovno, Rav Yitzhak Elchanan Spekta. And they said to him, you know, look how he's behaving, this Rav. You tell him he must start paskening the shalas again. And Rav Yitzhak Elchanan said, the same thing happened to me when I was Rav of Novodok. Over there, they didn't pay me for 10 weeks. And I also stopped and paskening the shalas. And the Rav is right. You pay me salary and you'll pasken the shalas. You'll be the Rav. So from that story, we get an insight into what it was like. It wasn't simple at all. So people say, you know, the rabbis, the system was a corrupt system. It caused such fracture in the community. Why didn't the rabbis do anything about it? And the truth is, back then and even today as well, the rabbis are quite powerless, because the only power that a rabbi has is moral influence. And moral influence doesn't work on immoral people. That's a very true statement that I heard from Rabbi Wein. I'll say it again, that the only power that a rabbi has is moral influence, and moral influence doesn't work on immoral people. So when you're dealing with immoral individuals, the rabbi's influence is not very significant and not very strong, and it's very much the same today as it was back then. To answer many of the criticisms of the Haskalah, of this anger in the community, of Jews leaving to embrace a secular life, so Rav Yisrael Salanter established the Muslim movement, as I mentioned. And the Muslim movement was a very successful change. Also, just like the Hasidic movement, which was revolutionary in Poland and in Ukraine, and really saved the Polish and Ukrainian Jewry at this time, at this very challenging time in our history. So the Muslim movement did a similar thing to Lithuanian Jewry. And it ensured that Jews were inspired once more, that Jews were clear in terms of their mission and their goal. It ensured that they would live with a heightened level of sensitivity to others and a more orderly way to dress and to behave. And so despite the long crushing exile and the difficulties that everybody faced, the Muslim movement was really a breath of fresh air and a glimmer of hope in the darkness and suffering of the Jewish people in Eastern Europe. The Muslim movement was very successful and very unsuccessful. It was very successful in terms of the fact that it took over all the yeshivas. All the great yeshivot became Musa yeshivot, although many Talmidei Chachamim at first opposed Rabbi Yisrael Salanter. As we know, in the Jewish world, we don't deal with change very well. And we're very suspicious of any changes that are introduced, because very often the changes come from an impure source and cause destruction. And only once we're certain that this is legitimate and real and will be positive for the community, we embrace any change. So it's not difficult for the one who is the initiator, is the protagonist of the change. But nonetheless, Rabbi Yisrael persisted, and he was successful in turning all the major yeshivas in Lithuania into Musa yeshivas. So Tells, Ponovich, Radin, Mir, Slobodka, they all became great Musa yeshivas. And to this day, the great yeshivas follow in the Musa Derech. They have a Musa Seder, and the introductions, the changes of Rabbi Yisrael, had a massive impact on the future learning and teaching within the Jewish world. However, the average Jew in Lithuania wasn't so much moved and changed by the Musa movement, although it would have an impact and infiltrate and take a time for it to get to the grassroots. But generally speaking, there wasn't a mass change in the approach of the average regular Jew in Lithuania. We see that Rabbi Yisrael, by the way, it's worth mentioning, was quite flexible in his introduction of Musa. And for example, one of his primary Talmidim, Rav Simcha Zissel Ziv, who opened a Musa yeshiva in Prussia, in Grumbin. And they saw, both Rabbi Yisrael and Rabbi Simcha Zissel, that unless there were secular studies, no Jews would come to that institution. And so that Musa yeshiva had secular studies as well as religious studies. When Rabbi Simcha Zissel moved the yeshiva to Kelm, and he opened the famous Kelm Talmud Torah, and he became known as the Alter of Kelm, so then there wasn't secular studies. So we see that they were flexible, they were broad, and they understood the needs for the Jewish people at the time. in spite of these two major innovations and changes within the Jewish world, that of the Yeshiva movement and that of the Muslim movement, and of course that of the Hasidic movement, but still many Jews left the ranks of Judaism. It was very difficult to stem the tide, and we found that very large numbers of Jews became secularized and no longer observant. After 1848, the ideas of communism and socialism took a very strong hold in Eastern Europe, and those ideas became a big part of the Jewish world. The outlook, the approach was that yes, there's many problems within the Jewish world, but if we solve the problems in general society, that's also going to solve the problems in Jewish society. If we make a perfect world, so it'll also be a perfect world for the Jews as well. The Bund, which was the Jewish labor union, was the largest political party amongst Jews in Eastern Europe. The Bund was very anti-religious. As late as 1939, on the eve of the destruction of European Jewry, the Bund had its annual banquet in Vilna on Kol Nidre Night, on Yom Kippur, and it was just a block away from the Shtiebel of the Vilna Gaon. So we see that the inroads that it made, socialism made within the Jewish community, was vast and significant. And those organizations were militantly anti-religious. The Jewish socialists and the Jewish communists, there were many of them. They came from observant homes. They came from religious homes. They even came from the homes of Rabbonim. It's quite hard to believe, but that's how it was. That's what was going on in the 19th century in Eastern Europe. The third primary approach to the Haskalah. So we've discussed the Muslim movement. We discussed the Yeshiva movement. Last week, as you know, this week we discussed the Muslim movement. There was a third approach of European Jewry to the tremendous pressures and difficulties they were experiencing in the 19th century. And that was to get up and leave, to leave Eastern Europe and find greener pastures for the Jewish world. And it's quite an unbelievable statistic I'm going to share with you. It's really incredible that from 1870 until 1914, in that period of time, from 1870 to the start of World War I, there were 2.5 million Jews that arrived on the shores of the United States from Eastern Europe, plus over probably about another 700,000 went to other places around the world. Isn't that unbelievable? 2.5 million Jews arrived in the United States between the years 1870 and World War I, plus about 700,000 to 800,000 Jews left Eastern Europe and went to other places. So we're talking about over 3 million Jews departed Eastern Europe in those years. And they went everywhere, not only to the United States. They went to South America, to Canada, here to South Africa, from Lithuania to Australia, anywhere they could go just to get out of miserable Eastern Europe. And when people move, it's very difficult for them to build the social infrastructure. They arrive in places where there's no social infrastructure, especially in the United States, which had a 6-day working week. I think here in South Africa, there were pressures to work on Saturday, but it wasn't as severe as it was in the United States. And the Jews had to work on Shabbos. They had to give up Shabbos, the holy Shabbos, and they had to work if they wanted to be able to support their families. They were under tremendous pressure, the immigrants that arrived in the United States and in other countries. And the children of these immigrants didn't want to have anything to do with the parents' old style and old way of living. You know, the children said, you talk funny. Those immigrants that went to the United States, with Western countries, you talk English funny. We hear of those that make aliyah. You hear the children saying, Lama tamar abe vrit kacha. Why do you speak Hebrew like this? Please don't speak Hebrew. So that's how it was. And there was a tremendous pressure to assimilate in the local culture, into the local country. Especially in the United States, there was a whole view, philosophy of what they called melting potism, that people come from different cultures, different places around the globe, and they enter into the melting pot of America, and they come out Americans. And so there were the numbers of assimilation were vast and were significant for these immigrants. And that culture was encouraged by the invention of the movies. Hollywood was run by Jews, by assimilated Jews, and it played a great role in the further assimilation of the Jewish immigrants that arrived in the United States. So as I mentioned, the movie industry, which was controlled by Jews, who themselves created an ideal world to justify their defection from Judaism. It's not by coincidence that the first sound movie was The Jazz Singer by Al Jolson, and it was the story of the son of a chazan who becomes a jazz singer, and he marries a non-Jewish girl, and by the end, he's accepted by the Jewish community, and they beg him to come and sing Kol Nidre for them on Yom Kippur in Shul with his Irish Catholic wife looking on and his mother and father approving of the matter. So one could see clearly that you don't have to be a genius to work out what the message is over here. And that message was drummed into United States Jewry from the very beginning. Even though there were large numbers that left Europe, over 3 million, towards the end of the 19th century. But by the end of the century, there were more Jews than the beginning of the century because there was such a high birth rate within the Jewish community. There's one more very significant event that I want to mention, which had a great impact on the Jewish world at that time, and that was the war between France and Prussia in 1870. The war took 6 months. The Prussians under Bismarck destroyed the French. Prussia later to become Germany, destroyed the French. They toppled the new republic. They took Alsace-Lorraine away from France, and France never got over this humiliating defeat. The French, the French always looked for a scapegoat and for a reason why they could explain to themselves how they were so easily defeated by the Prussians. In the early 1890s, the French newspaper, acting on a leak from the French general staff, said that they found the spy. They found the reasons. 20 years later, they say, now we know why we lost the war and why it was such a dismal failure, because there was a spy. Who was the spy? So the spy was the only Jew on the French general staff, an individual by the name of Alfred Dreyfus. And Dreyfus is really one of those characters in history who plays a pivotal role, but he never quite gets it. He can't work out why all of this is happening to him. He's the most unheroic hero that there is in the last 300 years of Jewish history. The trial took place. It was a very high-profile trial. It was the O.J. or the Oscar Pistorius trial of their day, and all the major newspapers covered it. They sent their journalists. Among them was a journalist from Vienna, an assimilated Jew by the name of Theodor Herzl. Although Herzl's grandfather was an Orthodox rabbi in Bosnia, Herzl himself was very assimilated. His son wasn't even circumcised, didn't even have a bris. And Herzl, in fact, Herzl's early years, he wrote in one of his columns that he thought that to sort out the Jewish problem, all Jews should convert to Christianity. That would be the most viable solution. And he said any rabbis who had any courage would encourage their community, their congregants, to be baptized and to become Christian. That was the early thinking of Theodor Herzl. He arrives at this trial and he sees pure and open anti-Semitism, that it's biased, that it's already set up from the beginning, and that it's just blatant anti-Semitism. And remember, this is France. France is the place of the French Revolution, of the beginning of the Enlightenment, of ideas of fraternity, liberty, equality. When Dreyfus is led through the streets to be disgraced before being deported to Devil's Island to die, the mob shouts, "Death to the Jews." Herzl, upon witnessing this, becomes a changed man. At that moment, Herzl becomes a Jew, and Herzl becomes a Zionist. And he said from then on that the only way for the Jewish problem to be solved is for Jews to become normal. What does it mean, normal? To have a normal state, to have a normal flag, to have a normal anthem, like any other nation. What Herzl said was that people don't hate the Guatemalans. People don't hate the Senegalese or the Ecuadorians, because they're a normal people with a normal state, and therefore that's the solution to the Jewish problem, and so political Zionism is born. Already in the 1870s, amongst the mass emigration of East European Jewry, as we mentioned earlier, there were individuals that went to Israel, they went to Palestine, and we see that throughout the 1800s, there was Jewish immigration into Palestine. Disciples of the Vilna Gaon went to Israel. disciples of the Baal HaTanya, the first Lubavitcher Rebbe, went to Israel in the 1800s, disciples of the Chasam Sofer. So by 1846, there's already a Jewish majority in Jerusalem. So that's not 1967, that's not 1948, already 1846, Jews are the majority in Jerusalem. And there's an organization at the time called the Chovevei Tzion. The Chovevei Tzion was an organization that encouraged, was made up of religious Jews. Chovevei Tzion means the lovers of Zion, and they too were pushing hard for Jews to move to Israel and to establish settlements in the land of Israel. Please stay with us. We'll be back shortly.
You're listening to Adventures in Jewish History with Rabbi Danny Sackstein.
So the Zionist movement takes root at the end of the 19th century. And already we've had the organization called Chovevei Tzion, which has been pushing for Jews to leave Europe and go to the land of Israel. The leader of that organization, Chovevei Tzion, which was a Orthodox, a religious organization that encouraged Jews to move to the land of Israel, was Rav Shmuel Moaleva. And Rav Shmuel Moaleva convinced Baron Edmund de Rothschild, who lived in France at the time, to sponsor Jewish settlements in the land of Israel. There were other barons, other very wealthy Jews that sponsored Jewish settlements in other parts of the world. For example, Baron Morris de Hirsch, he sponsored Jewish settlement in Argentina, in North Dakota, in New Jersey, in Tennessee. But Rothschild had the good sense to invest his money in the land of Israel. He set up agricultural colonies and established, which he supported. In 1882, the first bottle of wine of the Carmel Wine Company was made, which was Rothschild's company. Rothschild eventually gave the company to the workers. To this day, it's owned by the workers. And so the Zionist movement was able to combine with the Chovevei Tzion in order to gain some traction. But we see the larger part of the Zionist movement was made up of Jewish socialists, and it inherited the ideas of the Haskalah. What's interesting to note is that by the end of the 19th century, the beginning of the 20th century, so the Haskalah pretty much played itself out in the Jewish community. Why? Because the grandchildren of the early Maskilin, of those that leaded the Haskalah, were not Jewish anymore. They weren't interested in Jews. They weren't interested in Bialik and in Chada'am. And so the Zionist movement really revived the ideas of Haskalah within the Jewish world. In 1897, Herzl organized the first Zionist Congress in Basel in Switzerland. And he said, as a matter of prophecy, as almost prophetic, it's unbelievable, he said, "Today I'm founding the Jewish state. It'll take 50 years for us to see it." That's what Herzl said in 1897. And 51 years later, unbelievably, and thank God, Baruch Hashem, we see the establishment of the State of Israel. The Zionist movement had a slow start. It struggled. And those who came and were part of it were individuals who were idealists, who had strong convictions, and mostly they were secular Jews, socialists, anti-religious. And it was built on the premise that the new Jew would have to discard all that the old Jew represented and all that the old Jew did. And therefore there was strong opposition to the Zionist movement from the Orthodox Jewish world, an opposition that remained for many decades. In 1914, we see the terrible events of World War One. World War One is based on many miscalculations on both sides. Everybody thought it would be a short war. It lasted 4.5 years. 9 million soldiers were killed in Europe, and over 20 million people were killed in total, which is a massive number. You know, we see the Second World War is 50 million, but 20 million is also a huge number. And it destroyed many things, World War One. It destroyed the monarchies in Europe. Everybody was a loser in World War One. Even the winners were losers. But the biggest losers, perhaps, of all were the Jews, was the Jewish community. Because on the Eastern Front, the war was mainly fought in Jewish territory. And all the Jewish communities, the Pale of Settlement in Eastern Europe, were uprooted, and there was a tremendous amount of upheaval and dislocation for the Jews in Eastern Europe as a result of World War One. And not only that, but straight after World War One, we have the Bolshevik Revolution in 1917, which would also last for 4 years. It would be a 4-year civil war between the Reds and the Whites. And altogether, from this time, from 1914 to 1921, in those 7 years, 250,000 Jews were killed in Eastern Europe. Which, you know, relative to the Holocaust, it doesn't sound like a big number, but it's a massive number. 250,000 Jews died in 7 years, and the upheaval was indescribable for the established Jewish world in Eastern Europe, and really was the effective end of Eastern Europe for the Jews, although the total annihilation of Jews in Europe took place with the Second World War and the Holocaust. After World War I, again, there was a massive wave of immigration out of Europe, and Jews wanted to leave until 1924, and they were able to go to the United States. After that, there was the Restriction Immigration Act, which is still in place today in America. It really was an anti-Semitic law that was cloaked in a general way. But from 1924, it curtailed Jewish immigration from Europe into the United States, which was had a big impact and effect on the Jewish community. There was also at this time large numbers of Jews going to the land of Israel. The Balfour Declaration in November 1917 was stated that the British Empire supported the establishment of Jews in the national homeland in Palestine. And that was a very important landmark decision by the British government. And the Jews felt that if the British are going to be supporting such a thing, if the British government would support such a thing, it would actually happen. With Britain behind this idea, this concept of having a Jewish state, so there was a good chance that it would come into being. And so Jews went to Israel in large numbers at that time, after World War I. And most of them, as mentioned, were young, were secular, they're idealistic, they were socialists, they founded the Yeshiva movement, and they left behind and wanted to leave behind everything that the old world of Eastern Europe represented for Jews. Out of the wreckage of World War I, a number of countries were created. Most of them were artificial. We have the creation of Poland, the creation of Lithuania, Latvia, Estonia, Yugoslavia. And the common denominator of all of these new entities was official anti-Semitism. In Poland, we see that Jews were beaten constantly on the streets, that no Pole was ever convicted for murdering a Jew, that there were 3.5 million Jews in Poland after World War I, and that was about 10% of the Polish population. And even so, despite that, the anti-Semitic government coming to power, actually they entered into a coalition with the Jewish parties. And the Jewish parties were promised some short-term enticements, but very quickly this anti-Semitic government, which got in as a coalition with the Jews, turned on the Jews and became very discriminatory towards the Jews. They outlawed Shechita in Poland. They made it very difficult for Jews to run a store on Sunday. They said, you know, Sundays all the stores had to be closed, and so if a Jew closed their store on Saturday and Sunday, they couldn't stay in business. And so life was very difficult for the Jews in Poland after World War I. In spite of all this, the yeshivas rebuilt themselves, and the greatest revolution in Jewish life took place at this time after World War I, before World War II, and that was the education of Jewish women, which we'll describe in a moment when we return after this break.
You're listening to Adventures in Jewish History with Rabbi Danny Sackstein.
So the years between the wars were very difficult also for the Jews in Eastern Europe, as we discussed. But despite that, there was a strengthening and rebuilding of the yeshivas after World War I, and there was a great revolution in modern Jewish life with regard to the education of Jewish women. And that came in Poland in the 1920s, where Sarah Schneerer founded the Beis Yaakov movement. Sarah Schneerer was a tremendous person with great vision, and understanding, and she saw that the future of the Jewish world depended on Jewish women being educated, being inspired, being knowledgeable about Judaism, and that's why she established the Beis Yaakov movement. She encountered tremendous opposition from all sides of the Orthodox world. As I mentioned earlier, change doesn't go down easy and quickly within the Jewish world, but she was supported by the Ger Rebbe, she was supported by the Chofetz Chaim. They both saw the value and the importance of what she was doing, and with their support, she was able to establish the Beis Yaakov movement, which has proven to be essential and critical for the development, for the thriving, for the survival of the religious Jewish world in the 20th and 21st centuries. Today we see that the issue they confronted then was beginning to emerge, and it certainly is an important issue in our time, is that Jews, even observant Jews, need a secular education. We live in a world that's at very advanced technologically, and the advanced degrees necessary in every field, in every endeavor, without having a sufficient education, it's very difficult to function, to earn a living, to make a parnasa in this world. So that was already emerging in those days, but certainly we see it's much more acute in our times. As mentioned, the United States closed their doors to the Jewish community in 1924. Britain reneged on their promise with regards to the Balfour Declaration. They gave half of Palestine to Jordan to establish the Kingdom of Jordan. They restricted Jewish immigration and into the land of Israel. Even so, there were Arab riots in Israel and Palestine in 1923, in 1929, in 1936. The British, they suppressed those riots harshly, but they took very much into account going forward the opposition that the Arab world had to Jews returning to the land of Israel. We then have the events of World War II. We have the outbreak of war in World War II and Hitler's plan to dominate all of Europe, which he succeeded in doing in 1942. He controlled all the way from the English Channel to the Volga, was all under Nazi control. Hitler laid out very clearly what he planned to do in Mein Kampf. He didn't hide his intentions. He described how he would make the world, how he would develop a superior nation called the Aryans. They would control all of Europe, and they would make sure that Europe would become Judenrein, would be free of the traitors of the Jews who brought all evil to the world. So he openly says it in Mein Kampf what he plans to do. And that's exactly what he did. And Hitler went about exterminating the Jews of Europe. 6 million Jews murdered by the Nazis' killing machine of extermination. And you know, we couldn't speak about it enough. We could dedicate many, many talks to the Holocaust. We still don't have any answers to the Holocaust. But the suffering and destruction of the Jewish world is just unthinkable and indescribable. And then we have the incredible events leading to the establishment of the State of Israel in 1948 after World War II. So I think we need to dedicate a whole talk, a whole session to the establishment of the State of Israel and the miraculous events that took place in order to ensure that Israel will be established. So I think let's leave it there. And next week we'll continue and end our series of Crash Course in Jewish History with the establishment of the State of Israel, with the thriving and development of the State of Israel, and with Jews throughout the diaspora at the end of the 20th and beginning of the 21st century. Thank you so much for listening. Have a wonderful day.